On the show today, we mark the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. We'll be joined by WCGO's executive producer Daniel French, who was a radio reporter in New Orleans at the time. He'll discuss what he saw and heard from those trapped in the city when the storm hit, and what New Orleans was like when he returned. Then Jason Russell of the Washington Examiner tells us how charter schools helped re-educate New Orleans children after the storm. Stephen Horwitz from the Mercatus Center tells the story of Walmart's quick response. Finally, Abby Phillip from the Washington Post describes the different experiences whites and blacks have had in the rebuilding of New Orleans. I'm your host, Brad Jackson, and you're listening to Coffee and Markets on WCGO Chicago. Welcome to Coffee and Markets on WCGO Chicago. Don't forget, you can always stream the show live at 1590WCGO.com. You can find the show on Twitter at Coffee and Market. I am your host, Brad Jackson. You can find me at Brad W. Jackson. And don't miss subscribing to the podcast on iTunes so you can take Coffee and Markets wherever you go. Joining us now on the show, the executive producer here at WCGO, Daniel French. Daniel, thanks so much for being here. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Brad. Glad to be here.
Let's talk about New Orleans. This whole show is about the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. You were in New Orleans when the storm hit. You were there at a radio station. Why don't you tell us what it was like that day when the storm rolled through and what you saw from your vantage point at the station?
Sure. Let me tell you that before we even began at the radio station, the night before, everyone was curious as to whether Katrina would make a turn and head for New Orleans. And we woke up to see that it was headed directly at us. And the one thing that I will never, ever forget, Brad, is that it was the most beautiful day I have ever witnessed in my life. And I don't exaggerate. I don't know if it may have been the fact that we knew that a major storm was coming, but I think it was the environment that a storm like that creates. It's out in the middle of the ocean, but you could smell that something was different that day. The sky was bluer. It was truly almost a surreal experience to walk out and see that it was beautiful and something potentially devastating and ultimately devastating was headed our way. I lived on the North Shore.
Literally the calm before the storm.
Yes.
That was so beautiful.
Yeah. Yes. And again, I don't know if it was the charge of anticipation that everybody was feeling, but I think it's just whatever is involved in a storm of that magnitude, it presents itself. It announces that it's heading your way. And you can quite literally smell it, feel it, and see it as it heads your way. And what was kind of strange was I lived on the North Shore. And for anybody that knows that area, the North Shore is across the Lake Pontchartrain, the largest overland bridge, at least in North America, if not the world, 24, 26 miles, something like that. And as my now wife and girlfriend at the time were heading into the city, everybody else was leaving. And so that was a little strange to not have really any accompanying traffic going into the city and seeing something that looked like, you know, an end of the world movie where there's bumper to bumper traffic and people are fleeing. So that's what I remember ahead of the storm.
So when the storm hit, were you at the station at the time?
I was a junior cub reporter at WTIX, the Mighty 690, which I don't think it's there anymore. It's been through a series of ownership changes. But it was like the WLS in Chicago of New Orleans many, many years ago. It was the first station to play rock and roll, R&B, to play black artists alongside white artists. And in the early 2000s or mid-2000s, we switched to a talk station. And I had, you know, gone through the ranks, pushing buttons and producing minor league baseball, and was a news anchor at the time, an afternoon news anchor. And we were all on staff. Everybody was there. Well, all of the full-time employees stayed behind to report on the storm as best that we could, just to tell people what we saw.
And from your vantage point, you had the ability to, because you were a reporter, mm-hmm. see things and relay things that many people could not. What was the most shocking thing you saw during your reporting on the storm? Because there are so many stories, obviously the Superdome and people who
right.
had to be rescued on their rooftops. What was the most astonishing
yeah.
thing you saw?
Well, it got, the situation was dangerous enough that our boss pulled us all off the street and we returned to the studio because it was just, we were all pretty young. You know, that station, we were not the heritage station. We were the second fiddle in town, to WWL, the big daddy down there. And so I think the boss was kind of concerned that we were all green for the most part. And so he brought us back to the studio to report as best we could from there. But the thing that really told me that it was serious business was when I saw a dumpster roll down the street, just as if it were maybe sand, you know, blowing a dandelion or something like that. That's wow. How strong the winds were. It's a big green dumpster just flying down the street. Like, wow, this is really a big deal. This is not a joke. So I wouldn't say I saw as much as I heard as much. Because what we began to do when we were not reporting on the scene, we became kind of like an outlet for people's fears and frustrations, whether it was people that were on the road escaping New Orleans or people that were in their homes and riding out the storm. They would call us, and we basically held a 24-hour talk show. Call us. What are you experiencing? What are you seeing? And we would hear people say at the beginning of that broadcast, I'll never forget, there's a group of, I think it was seven dads who stayed behind in St. Bernard Parish, which is an adjoining parish from Orleans. And they all stayed to ride out the storm. And at the beginning of the night, they were all happy. They were partying. Oh, this is just no big deal. The wife and kids will be back in a couple days. And then they would call back and say, guys, this is getting serious. And then call back again, guys, we're actually scared. And then the last call we got from this particular group of people was, we're up in the second floor of one of these guys' houses, and the water is coming up the stairs. And that was, you know, you hear there's that laissez bon temps rouler, you know, that no worries whatsoever, let the good times roll. And it's always an attitude ahead of a storm like that. And the reality just became very visceral, very palpable. You heard fear in people's voices. After the levee broke, you know, before that, we thought we were okay. If you remember, initial reports from that storm was everything is okay. And then a couple hours later, it was things are not okay. The levee's been breached. The levee's been breached in a couple places, and the waters are beginning to rise.
Yeah, and the pictures I remember from that were just devastating. You saw entire neighborhoods underwater, like up to the rooftops, and you had the Coast Guard flying in helicopters, rescuing people off their rooftops. People pulling their dogs out of the water. When you heard from people, did you hear from people who had been rescued or who were waiting to be rescued?
We heard from people who were waiting to be rescued, and I'm not trying to be morbid, but I'm just telling you my experience. We heard from more than one and more than a dozen of people who were in their attics saying the water was coming up, or heard from a group of people who were in their attic or in their second floor, and the water was coming up, and we'll just swim out of there. Well, I can't swim. And what do you say to a person like that? They can't swim, and they're in their house, you know? Do you have a hatchet? Do you have an axe in your attic? You need to chop through your roof and get to the roof. It's probably the most emotional experience that I've ever had in my life, just talking to perfect strangers and hearing that they may be facing death and knowing that some of them did face death. You know, I can't even remember now if it was 13 or 1,800 people died in that storm.
1,800, yeah.
Yeah, 1,836, is that what it was? So that was a pretty bizarre experience for a young 20-something guy who just talking to people, you know, normal people, and you can't really do anything for them. That's pretty frustrating and something that will always stay with me.
Yeah, gosh. When you heard sort of in the aftermath, obviously the Superdome was the center of attention.
Right.
Did you hear from people in the Superdome? There were, you know, mixed reports about how terrible it was. Some people said, well, it wasn't as bad as was reported, but obviously it wasn't great. What did you hear from people in or who had left the Superdome?
The last time we personally heard from anybody in the Superdome was before the storm hit. After that, I didn't hear from anybody in the Superdome. But afterward, I did speak to a couple people who had been there. When we left several days after the storm and went to Houston because we just simply couldn't transmit, we had no gasoline. Our transmitter was blown into the Gulf, quite literally. We had four 2,500-watt transmitters that were just destroyed. We finally got out of town when things were starting to get kind of gnarly, if you know. There were bands of people who take advantage of an opportunity like this, breaking into pharmacies for drugs or for alcohol or whatever. And that's a very real thing. I mean, that's documented. And I think people tried to sugarcoat what happened and that it wasn't that bad. But I promise you, on the way out of town, we had heard from our friends at the big station in town that a cop had just been shot in the head. It was bad news. And I met a couple from Australia who was visiting, and they were in the Superdome, and they said it was horrific. Not to say that people were maiming each other or fighting or that it was some sort of, you know, Mad Max situation, but just the sanitary conditions were, you know, when you have no power in a facility like that and you have tens of thousands of people, there's no light, it's not a pretty picture. So anybody who went through that Superdome did not have a good time. I put it that way. It was bad, and bad people out on the streets took advantage. So anybody who was in the Superdome was very, very happy to get out of there.
You're listening to Coffee Markets on WCGO Chicago. Again, we're talking with Daniel French, who is the executive producer here, about his experience in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina. You mentioned that you evacuated to Houston. There were thousands upon thousands of people who did that. People obviously evacuated to plenty of other places, Atlanta as well. What was your experience once you got to Houston with other refugees, in a sense, who had all left New Orleans either before or after this storm? It has to be interesting to sort of be displaced and have an entire community almost displaced to places like Houston, Atlanta, and elsewhere.
There were a lot of tears and a lot of alcohol. That's kind of how we coped with it. You know, just remembering who had been left behind, hearing about various family members. Who was with you? How did you get here? What did you go through? What did you leave behind? Do you have any idea what your house looks like? Will we ever go back? That was a serious question. An answer by a lot of people. No, I'm not going back. After what I just went through, I am not going back. You know, another storm will hit. I don't have confidence in the government or the levees to keep me safe. It's not a place that I want to return to. And then there were always people, yeah, I'll go back, you know. But really, it was a lot of dejection and fear and very real worry about what the future held. You know, there were people with only the clothes on their back, no money, no bank cards, no anything. You know, what in God's name am I going to do? Maybe it was just our age, you know, like I said, early, mid-20s, we drank it away and hope for the better. I always knew I'd go back. I'm not a New Orleans guy by birth, but I really have an affinity for that city. And I returned, and I lived on the North Shore before the storm, and I moved into the city afterward and absolutely loved it.
So what was that like? Because there were parts of New Orleans that recovered more quickly than others.
Yeah.
There were parts that were not as damaged as others. When you moved back downtown, what was that community like after the storm?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Brad, because it's very important. You know, a history lesson in 25 words or less is post-World War II, the wood screw was invented, which allowed engineers to pump out swamps to easily extract the water from low-lying areas like New Orleans East, like the Ninth Ward. A lot of those homes were built on slabs, which is frankly insane. It was done because it was cheaper. Every house down there that is below sea level clearly should have been built up. It should have been raised. If you look at a topographical map and a population concentration map that the French themselves drew in the late 1700s, all of the areas in the, quote, sliver by the river were unflooded. All the areas that flooded, anybody 200 or 300 years ago could have told you that this was bound to happen. So when I moved back into the city, I moved into the Lower Garden District, and it was like nothing had happened. But if you go a couple miles to the east or the west or farther out east or across the river, in those low-lying areas, it looked not like a bomb. Yeah, maybe a mud bomb went off. Everything completely brown, up to the windows. And then there's that iconic, you know, cross, you know, with the the X with the number of people or bodies or whatever may have been found in the house on every single home that was flooded, that the National Guard would go spray paint on the side of the houses. But strangely, the areas where it didn't flood, it was fine. And then you just go a couple of blocks one direction or the other, and it's like a mudslide went through, which is basically what happened. Several of the guys I work with and friends and my boss, they had 20 feet of water. But really they had 6 feet of water because their homes were 14 feet below sea level. And without a Dutch-level intervention and feats of engineering, things like this are going to happen.
Yes, and there's been a lot of complaint that even all the work that they have put into it, in the end, it's something like this could happen all over again.
Far be it from me or anyone else to tell a family who has been two, three generations in a home that they can't move back to where they live. The American dream is great, but it was simply foolish that some of these places were built where they were built, and I'm sorry to say that. Like I said, the only way that we can do it, and the levee system that's been promised has mostly been delivered that they have there now. There are still some shortcomings, like the gates of the outfall canal aren't complete. But the truth is that that system down there is stronger than it ever was, and it's not piecemeal like it was before. The big problem that they're facing is wetland loss. I'm a fan of big oil, but if you fly over a lot of those wetlands, it does look, you can just see how it's been gouged by whether oil or fisheries. So there are a lot of culprits here. It's maintaining, and I think that they'll have 300-year, they call it 200-300-year or 100-year protection, whether or not 500-year protection. What that means is the big, big, big gargantuan storms that come along once in, you know, 5-10 generations, they're not convinced that they can withstand that. But something less than a Katrina, they're feeling pretty good about right now.
That's pretty amazing. Daniel French, executive producer here at WCGO, who was in New Orleans for the storm. We are marking the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina all day today on Coffee and Markets. Don't forget, you can always stream our show live at 1590WCGO.com. We will be back with more on Hurricane Katrina after this short break. Thanks for listening. Welcome back to Coffee and Markets on WCGO Chicago. Don't forget, you can always stream the show live at 1590WCGO.com. You can find the show on Twitter at Coffee and Market. I'm your host, Brad Jackson. You can find me at Brad W. Jackson. Joining us now from the Washington Examiner, Jason Russell is here. Jason, thanks so much for being here today. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So we're doing the whole show today on the anniversary of Katrina, and I wanted to talk to you about charter schools and how New Orleans has dealt with those. You wrote a great story on this. You told the story of Tom and Carolyn Crosby. Why don't we start there? Tell their tale here.
So Tom and Carolyn Crosby were running a charter school in New Orleans right before Katrina hit. They had evacuated to their second home or vacation home in Florida. And immediately they had to run back to open their charter school as fast as possible. Now they did have some government interference along the way. They had to become rechartered by the state of Louisiana because, for whatever reason the laws said that they were only allowed to operate in the two specific addresses that they had been operating at before. So they had to deal with that as they were reopening their school. But amazingly, because they were a charter school, they were able to open so much faster than all the public schools in the area. And so they opened up only 2 months after Katrina hit New Orleans, and it was another month, or at least until another public school was able to open.
Yeah, and that's pretty amazing. As you mentioned, the public schools took longer. So when you were in these neighborhoods, when the Crosbys were seeing the kids in need of education, you mentioned that there were actually hundreds of thousands of kids who were displaced and needed to go to school. I think you said it was the equivalent of 15,000 classrooms worth of kids. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah, 15,000 classrooms. That's a lot of kids. And you know, public schools, they're not as flexible as charter schools. and they don't have the incentive to, you know, take in these cases of kids that are troubled, probably traumatized from the evacuation and the damage that hit New Orleans. So charter schools around the country really stepped up. They, you know, charter schools from Los Angeles to Idaho to Cleveland, and Charlotte and Houston as well were offering to take in as many students as they could. And they were happy to arrange for shelter and even homes to live in when they could. And so they really stepped up and made sure that these kids were going to get an education, even if, you know, their families were displaced from their home.
Yeah, and it is pretty impressive to see the nationwide response to something like this. Talk about that, because I think the charter school community is perhaps closer than people might think.
Absolutely. No, it was really incredible. I read through tons of documents of emails and other things showing just how much they were offering their help. They didn't even have to, you know, seek out people to, you know, get their help. They were the ones coming to the central organizers of this movement to offer their help. So right after Katrina, the National Charter School community basically decided to set up a national hotline, and they had radio PSAs and all kinds of things to publicize the hotline so students and families could call in and get connected with a charter school that might have extra space for them. And as well, the other bonus of that hotline was that people were calling in to offer their help. It was teachers, it was people asking how they could donate, asking where they could volunteer their time. And so all across the country, people were calling this hotline and figuring out how they could help Katrina evacuees.
You mentioned in the piece that New Orleans schools before the storm were absolutely terrible, the public schools. And I was surprised that not only was that a problem, but, you know, you had these schools that had to deal with reopening. When you look at the public school issues after Katrina, what did you see?
Well, before Katrina, as you said, they were terrible schools. They were probably, they've been called the second worst performing school district in the second worst performing state in the nation. So it was clearly not the model school district that people want to emulate. But in addition, the school district was very corrupt. The FBI had to set up its own desk inside the school district's offices because there were so many cases of corruption they had to investigate. Now, since then, the state came in. They basically took over all but 10 or so of the schools in the New Orleans public school district and turned them into charter schools. So now today, as a result of those changes, every single family has a say in where their child is going to go to school, and 90% of those students have chosen charter schools over the local public schools.
That's pretty impressive. Was Katrina really the impetus for that? I mean, in essence, did its massive destruction enable these students to get an education that bureaucracy just never would have done on its own?
In a way, it was. It was the primary motivation was that the state recognized that so many of these schools were damaged and that they needed to come in and do something about them, or else they were going to be left by the wayside. But at the same time, it wasn't, you know, they still had an academic requirement for how they decided which schools they were going to take over. It had nothing to do with damage from the storm or anything like that. They basically said if your school performs below this certain score on the statewide test, then we're going to take over your school. And so that's why about 10 or so schools remained within the New Orleans Public School District. Eventually, many of those schools became charter schools, but there is about 4 or 5 schools that are still those public schools. So definitely, you know, if they had stayed within this centrally run public school district in New Orleans, these students would not have gotten the opportunity to choose from so many charter schools in the city.
And what's the charter school environment now like in New Orleans? The Crosbys obviously had a lot to do with that. What growth has the charter school community seen in New Orleans? You said a lot more of them are there now. Has it really helped foster the charter school community that we saw in response to the storm sort of within New Orleans now?
Oh, absolutely. The charter school movement is thriving in New Orleans. It's probably the biggest. It's definitely got more students in charter schools than any other city in the country in terms of proportion of student population. And let's look at the example of one particular charter school that I looked at in the piece. This is the Hines Charter School in the Lakeview neighborhood of New Orleans. This school was damaged from New Orleans, totally ruined, or sorry, from Katrina. It was totally ruined. And But today, it's a thriving charter school. They rebuilt the building thanks to its charter status. It opened up 3 years earlier than it would have as a typical public school. And today, it's just an amazing charter school. I toured it, and the students, they wear uniforms like a charter school. It has a French immersion program where these, second graders are speaking full sentences in French. It was very impressive. They have, much better behavior than they had before the storm. So it's been this incredible transformation in New Orleans. Citywide graduation rates are up. Scores on statewide tests are up. So it's clear that the charter system is working in New Orleans.
And really, in the end here, these kids are just getting a much better education, obviously French immersion, that they wouldn't have had beforehand, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's things like that. It's things that they're able to, they have the flexibility in this charter school that public schools don't have. They can try new things. They can try new programs. They can implement new incentives for good behavior and for doing well on math or in music or whatever. They had all kinds of neat software. The other thing is that the community engagement because of this school was incredible. But just when you give parents the opportunity to choose a school, that alone, helps them buy into the system. But two, this school set up ways for families to get involved through barbecues, through volunteer opportunities. It was really a community of parents making sure that other parents were also getting involved. So they were able to fundraise two $200,000 playgrounds because it was so successful.
Jason Russell from the Washington Examiner. Jason, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Welcome back to Coffee Markets on WCGO Chicago. Don't forget, you can always stream the show live at 1590wcgo.com. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast of our show on iTunes. You can take Coffee Markets wherever you go. Joining us now, Mercatus scholar Stephen Horwitz is here. Stephen, thanks so much for being on the show. It's great to have you.
My pleasure to be here, Brad.
Our whole show today is on Hurricane Katrina, marking the 10th anniversary. And you have done some great work talking about private sector response to this. I want to start with talking about Walmart. This is a company, obviously, that is, I believe, the world's second largest retailer at this point. And it really is a company that has logistic issues all the time. So when a hurricane rolled through New Orleans, this was really a private company that knew how to get itself and the community back on its feet quickly, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And, if you think about it, right, the challenges, those logistical challenges you're talking about getting resources to people who want them, that's what Walmart does every day. It's as if they're dealing with a hurricane every single day in the sense of sort of knowing, what customers want and how to get things from place to place. And, they have their own weather forecasting folks in-house and they can track with others. They knew what was coming and they had their equipment and their people and their supplies in place to respond very quickly when New Orleans and really the rest of the Gulf Coast was hit so hard by it.
When you look at the response, you showed, you did this video, which I thought was great, these just lines and lines and lines of trucks from Walmart ready to bring in supplies both for the store and the community. It really was an organization that I think responded well to help its neighbors, right?
Yeah, and I think when you think about it, right, there's a couple things to keep in mind there. One, clearly they have a profit incentive, right? If they can get, 126 stores were damaged, were closed from the storm, and they got almost all those reopened within a week or 10 days. So they want to make money, but that's good, right? I mean, in the sense that that gives them the incentive to be able to get those supplies where they need to be. But it's also the case that Walmart employees are members of those very communities, right? And so, their employees have motivations beyond simply the bottom line to want to get those stores reopened, to get water, to get bleach, to get mops into, devastated areas. As quickly as possible to help themselves and help their neighbors and get those communities moving again. And yeah, those long lines of trucks were because Walmart, knew what was coming and they had them staged. One problem, of course, was that in a number of places, particularly around New Orleans, FEMA, in some cases the National Guard, but really FEMA, was hesitant to let them through and didn't, it's a disaster area. What do you guys, why is Walmart coming through? It seems weird to say that when Walmart, the trucks are sitting there, right, with all kinds of supplies that people need. But that's a great example of the private sector versus the struggles of the government bureaucracy.
Yeah, especially because we all saw the bumbling response that FEMA had, excuse me. And I think the example you point out of Walmart's quick response, how they had a plan in place ahead of time for what to do in a hurricane, really makes such a drastic difference when you compare it to FEMA's plans and FEMA's response. But I guess some of that, as you mentioned, is that FEMA doesn't really respond to something like this on a regular basis, so perhaps they didn't have the forethought to do something like this that Walmart does, right?
Yeah, I think that's part of it, right? I mean, there's a couple issues facing organizations like FEMA, right? One is they don't have to do this. They don't have to do the logistical stuff on a, you know, on an everyday basis. So, you know, just moving things from place to place is a challenge for them. And Walmart, again, Walmart's used to having to do that and having the signals of the marketplace to guide them, and FEMA just doesn't have that. And so, you know, they're taking a shot in the dark. But FEMA also faces some other kinds of, you know, problematic incentives. The incentive for FEMA to sort of get in quickly and to take risks and to sort of do things, you know, sort of in that forward proactive way, those incentives aren't there, right? If FEMA steps in quickly and sort of, let's say, a couple of, you know, FEMA employees should get killed or hurt or something, right? All the negative press is there. If they wait and sort of back off and don't come in until 10 days later, which is pretty much the case, right? Well, they might get hammered for being late, but that's less of a price to pay for, you know, inaction than for actually coming in and hurt, you know, sort of getting their people hurt. Walmart, on the other hand, faced the, you know, they have reasons to want to get in quickly. Again, sort of those profit and community-based reasons they want to get in. And they had two vice presidents in New Orleans the next day with satellite phones trying to figure out what are we going to do, right? So the speed of the response here, I think, is also driven by the kind of bureaucratic incentives and public relation incentives that are different in market economies and private sector firms versus government bureaucracy.
You tell the story of two managers in this that I thought were just really amazing. There was a manager of a store who got a bulldozer, went through her store, picked up stuff that was still good that she thought the community would need, and then just put it in a pile in the parking lot and was like, hey guys, come get it if you need it.
Yep. And you know, what's interesting about those stories is we tend to think of Walmart as this sort of very anonymous, hierarchical, you know, typical top-down corporation. But the reality of Walmart is that their actual, you know, this is an assistant manager who did that, and their lower level employees actually get a fair deal of responsibility. If you ever go to Walmart, you'll see them, you know, with those little scanner guns they have, right, checking on inventory and all that. That taps them right into the database in Bentonville, and they're giving this to the, you know, to their associates. And so they do give that responsibility, and Walmart's leadership, as the storm was approaching, you know, Lee Scott, the CEO at the time, said to his vice presidents and passed down the message that, look, you know, people are going to have to make decisions based on limited information, and that people should make the best decision they can with the information they have, and above all, do the right thing. And for all the weird sort of, you know, corporate culture things, there's this, you know, Walmart cheer, and they have these, you know, employee meetings and all these sorts of things we think are kind of kitschy and hokey. But what that does is it establishes that kind of corporate culture where people know what the firm's values are and know that, you know, someone like that assistant manager who scooped all that stuff out, you would think the bosses would come down on her, but Walmart's higher up said, no, this is exactly the kind of thing we expect our employees to do in that kind of situation. She was praised for what she did.
Well, and the other one that you mentioned was a manager who got into the pharmacy and got needed medications that could not get into New Orleans otherwise, and yep, took them to hospitals and senior centers and places where they needed this medicine but could not get a hold of it, right?
Yep, and that's again same sort of thing here. That sort of initiative was praised by the Walmart higher ups to say, you know, you're in an unusual situation, you need to do the right, you know, do the right thing, and they did. And that, I think, it's an interesting story there about how about, you know, compared to the image we often have of corporate America, especially Walmart, much vilified, right? Here's a case where Walmart empowered its lower level employees, and not only, you know, empowered them, but basically empowered them to do things that we think are the sort of ethically right thing to do in those kind of situations, even at what was clearly right a cost to Walmart's bottom line. But they were fine with that, as were many other firms, you know, throughout the region who undertook activities that, you know, were clearly costing them, but they knew, you know, would pay off, the right thing to do. It might pay off in the long run. Just one quick example that's not mentioned in the video. The McDonald's on the Gulf Coast, one, provided free food for first responders, wherever they could get stores back open. Any first responders who came in got free food from McDonald's. And essentially what the McDonald's leadership said to the manager in that area and their disaster relief people was, look, we're not even going to give you a budget. You do whatever it takes to get those stores open and to find your employees and to get things back going again and to take care of the people in your community. And as far as I know, to this day, no one's ever really totaled up what McDonald's spent doing that, but they knew that that's what, that was the right thing to do for their, again, for their employees who are members of those communities as well.
See, and these are stories that you've told that I don't think a lot of people know, and the fact that it's 10 years later, and this is something that, like, I didn't know the McDonald's thing. I had heard about some of this Walmart, but I didn't know that McDonald's story, and the fact that it's 10 years later and it's something that still is not very well known is pretty amazing to me. This storm just has stories like that, yeah, time and time again, even 10 years later.
Yeah, another good example of this is what the Marriott hotel chain did. And this is, Walmart did this as well, which is basically to say to their, any of their employees who were in stores that were, you know, damaged or couldn't rehire all their employees, said, if you walk into another Walmart or another Marriott anywhere else in the country, we'll guarantee you a job. And so a number of firms did that, and Marriott hotels in Houston and other places were taking in Marriott employees from the Gulf Coast area, often with their entire families. You know, and again, this is not just like managers and chefs, but this was housekeeping staff, whomever, right? They provided, Marriott, I know, provided several thousand dollars of spending money to displaced employees. So a lot of firms really did the right thing here, and it is really frustrating, I think, even 10 years later, that these stories. I think the Walmart story, you know, if I can say this, I think my work on the Walmart story has helped get that one out there. But I think these other stories are still not very well known. And it's very frustrating to think, you know, people know how badly FEMA screwed up. But what people don't know is the other stories, the good stories, the productive, positive stories about how the recovery happened. And it wasn't just the private sector, right? It was, you know, the other civil society institutions and so on that did a lot of good things that did go, especially, haven't been talked about, especially in the last 10 years.
Before we go here, what could FEMA learn from this private sector response, from Walmart, from McDonald's, from Marriott, and these other companies that went in there and did good quickly?
Well, you know, the answer, frankly, is not a lot. I mean, the problems aren't bad management at FEMA, right? The famous scene with Bush saying "heck of a job, Brownie." Well, as if it wouldn't matter who was in charge. The incentives and the knowledge problems that FEMA faces are structurally built into government agencies. What I think, the one thing that FEMA can learn, I think, is, and what more importantly, what has been learned by a lot of disaster response organizations at the local level, is to incorporate the private sector into their protocols. So what we don't want to see happen is we don't want to see the various, you know, particularly the sort of government law and order type agencies blocking private sector firms from coming in. In fact, what we'd like to see is to have the local emergency management folks incorporate what the private sector might be able to do into their protocols and planning, so we don't have the problems of those, you know, trucks not getting into New Orleans. I certainly think that's one of the lessons to be learned from this. And in fact, we've seen it happen on the local level. You know, I think the general problem with FEMA is that disasters are rarely federal. They're rarely nationwide, right? Disasters are local. And I think if FEMA could learn a lesson, it would be to get out of the business of directly helping itself and giving us trailers full of formaldehyde like they did in New Orleans, but moving that responsibility more local.
Stephen Horwitz from the Mercatus Center. Stephen, thanks so much. Welcome back to Coffee Markets on WCGO Chicago. Don't forget, you can always stream the show live at 1590WCGO.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes so you can take Coffee Markets wherever you go. Joining us now on the line from the Washington Post, Abby Phillip is here. Abby, thanks so much for being on the show this morning. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
My daughter's name is Abby as well. Good name. Applause. It's a great name. Let's talk about Hurricane Katrina. This week marks the 10th anniversary, amazingly enough, of Hurricane Katrina, which goes down in the record books as one of the worst natural disasters we've ever had. You did a great piece about the disparity on how people feel the city has recovered, between those who are white and those who are black. Let's talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, when you think about Hurricane Katrina, I think a lot of people remember seeing the devastation, seeing people sitting on the rooftops. The thing to remember about a lot of that is that a lot of the most severe devastation happened in areas where a lot of the city's Black residents lived and where a lot of those people were also poor and maybe didn't have the resources to leave in the first place. So as a result, 10 years later, I think a lot of people had a lot more, or a lot of those people had a lot more to recover from and don't feel this sense that things have really bounced back for them. It's bounced back in the downtown areas where things are a lot more gentrified, where we're talking about, higher income areas, more white areas. But in the neighborhoods where a lot of the Black residents live, you can actually see that there's a very stark difference between what's going on downtown and what's going on in where their homes are.
You know, I think as just about everybody remembers seeing those pictures from the air of just the amazing devastation in that city as the entire city almost was underwater. You're right. When you looked at the rooftops of people that the Coast Guard were rescuing, it seemed a lot of them were poor African Americans, especially in was it the lower Ninth Ward that got hit the hardest? I think that was one of those places where the devastation was just astonishing.
Right. The lower Ninth Ward remains to this day just empty. I mean, this was a place where there were some 16,000 people living there, predominantly African American. 90-something percent of the population there are African American. Today, they're struggling to get to about 2,000-3,000 people in the lower nine. So that just goes to show how far things are from recovery there 10 years after the storm. There are entire blocks where there's only one house. And there are efforts ongoing to fix that, but the challenges are enormous. I was looking at the numbers just before coming to talk to you, and some 35 or 40% of the people living in the lower nine were living below the poverty line. So these are people who would have had difficulty coming back to begin with, and even after all this time has passed, they haven't really caught a break.
That really is amazing, and you were mentioning in your piece that a lot of these people who were displaced were poor. I remember a lot of them moved to places like Houston and further up the road in Louisiana. So when you look at how the difficulties these people had to overcome to return to their city and return to perhaps a house that was no longer standing, is that one of the primary reasons that the African American community believes that this city is not recovered as much as other folks do?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Taking the lower nine again as an example, one of the major factors in that community is that these homes were actually owned in families for generations after generations. But that meant that they didn't have property insurance, they didn't have mortgages, and so if they were going to rebuild their home, they would have to be starting completely from scratch. Now, if they had evacuated to halfway across the country, to Houston, to Atlanta, to Baton Rouge, they would have needed to have the financial ability and, frankly, the willpower to come back after all this time. Many of these people, I talked to several people who say, I have a brother, a sister, they want to come back. They just can't get everything together to rebuild this house from scratch. They have to file tomes of paperwork to the government to apply for some of these disaster relief programs. Again, these are people who do not have the means and need a lot of help in return.
You did some interesting breakdown on some of these numbers, including if schools were better, if the economy was better, and if healthcare was better. And in I think all of those cases, African Americans had a great difference in their answer than white New Orleans residents, right?
Yeah, and some of that you have to attribute to the changing demographics of the city in general. A lot of the newer residents of the city, some of them who weren't even here for the storm, they are, they tend to be white, they tend to have more money, they tend to be better educated. So they're not really comparing pre-storm to post-storm. That's one factor. Another factor is just that these people live in very different parts of the city, so their experiences are very different.
There was a NPR story I was listening to while I was dropping off my daughter Abby at school this morning, and they were talking to a woman who decided to stay in her house with her husband, and they moved to the second floor during Hurricane Katrina, and the entire first floor was flooded, but they were determined to stay and you know, guard their house and ride it out, and that she said most of her neighborhood is still not back yet. They put a lot of effort into redoing their home, but a lot of her neighborhood couldn't say the same. Is it a story like that where some neighborhoods are fine, they've rebuilt, they had enough insurance money behind them that they could do that, and other neighborhoods that were poorer perhaps did not and were relying more on NGOs to come in and help rebuild the community?
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, you have to go neighborhood to neighborhood. Every neighborhood is a little bit different. In places where people were able to come back sooner and they were able to rebuild, that helped because, you didn't really want to be in your neighborhood alone. And so if your next door neighbor had come back, you were more likely to feel safe coming back as well. And it's sort of a ripple effect. I mean, it's like a ball rolling down the hill. As long as there's sort of momentum for rebuilding, that momentum tended to continue. So you have some places where you drive around and it's almost like nothing happened. But then there's other parts of the city where you drive around and you can see the devastation. You can see that there are empty lots. There's overgrown grass. There are boarded up buildings and storefronts. You have to drive street by street to really see what is going on in people's lives, and it really does depend on where they were located geographically. It depended on the sort of wherewithal of the neighborhoods and the NGO activity and the nonprofits who were working there. And, you know, that continues to this day.
One of the other things posted on was their healthcare, what they thought the healthcare options were like before and after the storm. I think a lot of people will remember that picture of New Orleans Charity Hospital that was just completely devastated after the storm, and it was forced to close down. When you look at that and how people are adapting to new healthcare post-Katrina, what did you see?
It's very interesting. I spent some time in the area where the charity hospital was. They've since rebuilt a new hospital, but that didn't happen until last year. So for much of the last 10 years, there were people in parts of New Orleans who had to go far distances to get access to healthcare. Now, meanwhile, between 2005 and now, there were changes nationally in access to healthcare. So I think you see some of that showing up in the numbers. But you also have certain neighborhoods that went 9 years without a hospital. Someone told me that, every time they saw an ambulance going through their neighborhood, they would say a prayer for that person because they knew they had to go driving a long distance to get to the hospital and they might not make it. That's a very serious thing for people. You couldn't live in an area where there's no access to healthcare or no access to healthcare if you have a very serious condition for long. And there were people who, in some parts of New Orleans, who went almost a decade without close access to a hospital.
Real quick, in 30 seconds or less here, when you look at 10 years from now, 5 years, 10 years from now, how do you think the population of New Orleans is going to view Hurricane Katrina at that point?
It was a major setback for people here, particularly if you were poor. It made the gap between the haves and the have-nots a lot worse. But at the same time, we're sitting here talking about this because the storm really unmasked things that were probably going on in New Orleans before the storm. And there's a real opportunity, a golden opportunity for the city to recover and to rectify some of these issues.
Abby Phillip from the Washington Post. Abby, thanks so much. We appreciate you being here.
Thanks for having me.